Okay, so we have a woman who disappeared on September 10th, 2001. We have 9/11. We have a frantic search. Then what? What do we know? In many ways, it's easier to highlight what we don't know. Was Sneha alone when she was last seen alive in Century 21, the department store? Or was she with another woman? Why wasn't Sneha caught on camera anywhere other than the woman's coat area, especially the shoe area, where she made her final purchase? Where did Sneha go after Century 21? Did she really tell Sonia Mora, the shoe saleswoman, that she was going to Victoria's Secret and Jones, New York? Did Sneha speak with either or both of her brothers the day she disappeared? If so, what did she say? Did Ron Lieberman, Sneha's husband, sleep dial his cell phone from his landline at 4:05 a.m. on 9/11? Does that explain the otherwise unexplainable call made from inside the apartment? Is the woman who exited Sneha's building at 8:43 a.m. on 9/11 actually Sneha? Did Sneha attend a party on September 10th at a hotel next to the Twin Towers? Did she go shopping on 9/11 in the mall underneath the towers? Did she visit Windows on the World on top of the North Tower? Was she just walking home when the attacks began? Or none of the above? We don't know. Most of all, where did Sneha stay the night of the 10th? And as if this wasn't enough, let me throw a few new questions at you. First, how did Sneha's family know that she dropped off dry cleaning on 9/10 after she left her apartment, but before she got to Century 21? Maybe credit card records? But wouldn't she have paid when she picked up her clothes, not when she dropped them off? So did her family interview someone at the dry cleaners? And if so, what did that person say about Sneha's state of mind? Was she with someone then? Was she caught on security footage there? We don't know. Finally, in the Century 21 footage, Sneha does not appear to be wet, nor is she carrying an umbrella, even though it was storming outside. So did she walk to Century 21? Maybe during a pause in the rain? Did someone drop her off? Or did she take a cab? We don't know. What happened to Sneha? And if the explanation really is so simple, why are there so many discrepancies and unanswered questions? I don't know. We don't know. No one knows. Not the NYPD, not private investigators, not us. Not yet. For My Heart Media, this is Missing on 9/11, the story of one woman who vanished on the eve of history and my quest to find her. I'm your host, John Walczak. On October 30th, 2001, NYPD Detective Richard Stark ends his investigation into Sneha's disappearance. "There's nothing left to do," he says. Sneha's family vehemently disagrees. Their private investigator, Ken Gallant, continues to hunt for clues. He finds few, if any. By coincidence, the same day Detective Stark ends his investigation, Sneha was supposed to be in court, facing charges of harassment, assault, and falsely reporting an incident. But because no one knows where she is, her case is adjourned again. 2001 ends. Then, on January 16, 2002, a judge issues a bench warrant for Sneha's arrest. She's not showing up to court, she's AWOL, and since there's no official declaration of death, he has no choice, he says. 1 month later, the Associated Press runs a short article about Sneha. Quote, "Police theorize she orchestrated her own disappearance to escape personal problems." But her family says this doesn't make sense. Sneha was accomplished, graceful, and stable, they say. Ron says, quote, "We had a great marriage. We were talking about having babies." The NYPD, however, says that Sneha's disappearance is unrelated to the World Trade Center. By August 2002, the initial list of thousands of people missing on 9/11 has been whittled down to just 90. Some victims were reported missing multiple times by different people, a genuine mistake. Then there were cases of fraud. But also, amazingly, at least seven people initially thought to have died on 9/11 are found alive. According to the New York Post, one is a homeless man named Albert Vaughn, last seen in a subway station beneath the World Trade Center. In June 2002, 9 months after the attacks, his family finds him in a psychiatric hospital. Another, George Sims, was thought to have been working as an informal street vendor near the Trade Center on 9/11. Like Vaughn, Sims is found in a psychiatric hospital, diagnosed with amnesia and schizophrenia. On September 11th, 2002, the one-year anniversary of the attacks, Sneha's family holds a small memorial service in Poughkeepsie, New York. Publicly, they've given up any hope that Sneha will be found alive. Privately, though, some of them still do not believe that she's dead. Nonetheless, they bury an urn with unidentified ashes collected from Ground Zero. 1 month later, Sneha's husband, Ron, files a claim with the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund, worth $3 to $4 million. But because Sneha is not an official 9/11 victim, because there's no death certificate, it's denied. By this point, Sneha's family is starting to get ticked off. Publicly, they've settled on the hero narrative that Sneha ran into the burning towers to help people and died as a result. They say they're not motivated by money. Instead, they're motivated by legacy. They want recognition for Sneha's bravery, or, and there's no way to say this nicely, her theoretical bravery. Still, the city of New York declines to issue a death certificate stating that Sneha died on 9/11 at the World Trade Center. On September 25th, 2003, Ron files a petition seeking a judicial declaration of death. 2 months later, a lawyer named Ellen Winner is appointed as Sneha's guardian ad litem. Basically, it's Ellen's role to fight for Sneha on her behalf, to serve as her advocate in absentia. In turn, Sneha's family hires a lawyer named Mark Bogatin.
I was retained by Ron Lieberman, and he was the surviving spouse, to bring this proceeding in Surrogates Court. And that's what I did. I filed a petition in Surrogates Court for the judicial declaration of death.
We interviewed Bogatin at his Manhattan office, about 1,200 feet northeast of the World Trade Center, on January 5th, 2021, the day before the Capitol riot in D.C. We sat in a conference room, faces covered because, well, COVID. It was gray and drizzly. Looking out the window, we could see Bogatin's old office, the one he had on 9/11, only two blocks away, near City Hall. That's where he was headed on 9/11 when the attacks began.
I had just gotten out of the subway, Chambers and West Broadway, and started to walk, and I hear above me a plane, or see a plane. I look, the plane, and it's going, it goes right into the Trade Center. Boom, explodes. And I said, my God, it's awful. And I said, all those people now, awful. Then also people gathering and stuff. And so I was a block away now. I just moved the block away, still looking. And then I saw this explosion in the tower. I saw this big explosion of the flames coming out. And I thought it was maybe a bomb or maybe it was some like grenade attack, mortar attack. So I didn't actually see the second plane. But you know, once I saw that, everybody saw that, everybody knew then it was terrorism, obviously.
Bogatin made his way into his office, which had a partial view of the Trade Center.
All of a sudden, everybody was running. I mean, people were just standing watching, and it was running. Said, oh, something happened. I don't know what happened. And then I heard on the TV that the first one fell down. And so then I looked out my window. The second one was still there, and I left. And then the whole area was closed for like a week or so. But I remember that. I remember calling the court, and they say, oh, yeah, we know what happened. We've heard. No, there's no court today.
A few years later, Bogatin got a call from his friend, Mark Freiberg, a fellow attorney.
Mark Freiberg had represented Snea and Philip before she disappeared. So basically, Mark Freiberg came to me and told me about the case, said that Snea and Philip lived across the street from the Trade Center. And he first told me, you know, she went missing on September 11th. They said, actually, she went missing on September 10th, or was last seen on the 10th, which made the case obviously a little bit different. And Mark Freiberg had been representing Snea and Philip. She had a very small criminal case pending in the New York City Criminal Court, and he'd represented her in that, and that was pending on 9/11. And then, you know, she disappeared on 9/11. And so what happened was, initially, when whatever agency was putting together the list of the dead, people who died at the Trade Center, Snea and Phillips' name was originally included on the list prepared by the government of those who died, not missing, but died at the Trade Center.
At the very beginning, Sneha was listed as the 9/11 victim.
After 9/11, some public agency brought a proceeding on behalf of everybody on the list, the 2,700 people who were on the list, and there were no body recovered. There was a proceeding brought in surrogate court to have them judicially declared dead and death certificates ordered issued by the surrogate for those 2,700 people. And again, with the mass proceedings, Sneha was included in that. As a result of that proceeding, you know, the facts showed that everybody would be entitled to a death certificate that they died at the Trade Center, except for two people. And one of the two was Snea and Philip. And there were two cases where the surrogate's representative said, it's not fraud, but we just need more evidence and we need more information before we feel comfortable issuing a death certificate. And again, Snea was one of these two cases. And
was the other one Lafuente?
Juan Lafuente. Another strange case, strange enough that it's worth going into a bit of detail. Juan Lafuente was last seen alive around 6 a.m. on 9/11 on his way to a train station in Poughkeepsie, New York, where he lived with his wife, Colette. At the time, Colette was the mayor of Poughkeepsie. Juan worked for Citibank at 111 Wall Street in Manhattan. On 9/11, he made it to Grand Central Station, where he swiped his Metro card at 8:06 a.m. Then, presumably, he caught a subway to Wall Street and Broadway, 1,100 feet southeast of the World Trade Center. Per court records, that trip typically took about 16 minutes. Juan likely exited onto the street around 8:30 a.m., only 16 minutes before American Airlines Flight 11 hit the North Tower. However, like Sneha, Juan did not work at the Trade Center. He had no real reason to be there. In fact, typically, after exiting onto the street, he would have walked the other way to his Wall Street office. So, in order to say that he died on 9/11 at the Trade Center during the attacks, his family, like Sneha's family, had to answer why he was there in the first place. At first, they too chose the hero narrative. They said that Juan probably saw the attacks and ran into the towers to help people. As evidence, they cited the fact that he was a volunteer fire marshal. Later, though, a witness came forward and claimed that two or three days before 9/11, he overheard Juan say that he planned to attend a meeting at the Trade Center. Okay, but which meeting? Best guess. The Risk Waters Financial Technology Congress at Windows on the World on top of the North Tower on the morning of 9/11. However, as with Sneha, there's no proof that Juan was at the Trade Center. No evidence. Just speculation. As to the critical question of why he would have attended the conference, why he died, his family ditched the hero narrative and instead cited frugality. They posited that he wanted free food. Juan was so frugal, according to the New York Times, that, quote, he scavenged his morning paper from a dumpster. His frugality is why he died, according to his family. His wife, Colette, said, quote, it was a free breakfast. Now, with Lafuente, the cops did consider non-9/11 explanations. For one, suicide. Juan was undergoing psychiatric treatment for depression. Coincidentally, on 9/11, he had an 8 p.m. appointment with a psychiatrist, which obviously he missed. They also considered whether or not he ran off. Juan and Colette had an interesting marriage. According to the Times, once a month, Juan stayed away from home overnight in Manhattan in a, quote, shabby genteel tourist hotel. As to what Juan did at the hotel, a manager said, quote, we don't ask those questions. In addition, Juan's daughter, who said she had a good relationship with him, could not remember whether or not he called her on her birthday, September 10th. So, exercising caution, Poughkeepsie Detective Walter Horton considered everything. He told the Times, quote, I don't want to find out 6 months from now that he's living in the Bahamas. But in the end, a judge ruled that 9/11 was the answer, writing, quote,
the absentee was described in polite terms by his wife and Detective Horton as a frugal person. He would often take advantage of trade shows offering free refreshments, such as the one sponsored by Risk Waters the morning of September 11th. It is tragically ironic that the absentee's zest for thriftiness was the underlying factor which may have contributed in large part to his unexpected demise. Under the totality of the circumstances, there is no reasonable explanation for his disappearance other than death by an act of terrorism. Therefore, the court determines that Juan M. Lafuente died September 11th, 2001.
And with that, the Lafuente family, unlike Sneha's family, got a death certificate quickly. Mark Bogatin, the attorney hired by Sneha's husband, Ron, later referenced the Lafuente case multiple times in court, arguing that, in Sneha's case, like the Lafuente case, 9/11 was the obvious answer.
Just common sense. I mean, even without court being involved, if somebody came to me and I was talking to somebody in a bar and they gave me these facts, it's just obvious to me. What else could have happened? She died at the Trade Center. Why would you even consider anything else? It's like I said, you can't say 100%. There's no alien abduction here. But I'm pretty confident, as a rational human being, it's highly unlikely there was an alien abduction. And it's more than highly unlikely there was some foul play. So other than obviously the foul play involved in what Al-Qaeda did.
This is not what Sneha's family originally thought. In the beginning, they wanted the NYPD to investigate everything. Suicide, murder, everything. But by the time Mark Bogatin enters the picture, late 2003, early 2004, both Sneha's family and the NYPD, despite previous clashes, agreed that Sneha did die on 9/11 at the Trade Center. Now, though, someone else is on the case. Ellen Winner, the guardian ad litem, the attorney appointed to represent Sneha in absentia. And basically, she says, not so fast.
She was appointed by the court to represent Sneha's interest. And what she did is she investigated the facts like I investigated the facts. And basically, her report said, well, there's evidence that Sneha led a dangerous lifestyle, that she went to bars and lesbian bars or bisexual bars. Or I forget how they characterize it. I think they're called bars frequented by women, I think is what one of the reports referred to them as. And that she may have been unfaithful and she may have, whatever. So she pointed to this dangerous, in her mind, dangerous lifestyle as an alternative explanation for Sneha's disappearance. So basically the theory that, very possible she went into the bar, had the unfortunate circumstance of striking up an acquaintance with a person who turned out to be a crazed killer. And that's how she met her demise. Demise, to use a stupid term. Demise. And that's the explanation. So since she had this dangerous lifestyle and went to bars, it may have been lesbian. She didn't say she died because she was lesbian, but she did say because she frequented bars and may have been unfaithful and struck up acquaintances with strangers at these bars, that somehow, she had a dangerous lifestyle. So we can't say with any confidence, can't rule out foul play. That was her take on it. And that actually was the conclusion reached by the surrogate, who was the judge. And the final decision from the surrogate was because that there was this dangerous lifestyle and she went to these bars and stuff and all these, these things in her background, can't say that, you can't rule out foul play. And in my mind, that's just that's crazy because, for the reasons I've already said, it's just crazy. NYPD thought it was crazy. Private detective thought it was crazy. And if you're going to go and say she was killed by a crazed killer, you know, there has to be some evidence of that, something. So the circuit court rules, yes, she's dead, she's gone. I think they set her date of death as 3 years after her disappearance, meaning she didn't die at the Trade Center. And that was very upsetting, extremely upsetting. Well, when her name was removed from the list of people who died at the Trade Center, that was very, very upsetting to the family. By the family, I mean her mother and father. I mean Rama's not happy either. I met the parents later in the representation, and the first time I met them, I saw the mother, and she said to me, Stia was an American hero, and meaning that she's one of the people who died at the Trade Center. And it was the first time that I really appreciated, obviously from the beginning I understood what the death of one's child would mean, does mean, obviously I appreciated that. But I didn't appreciate how the fact that she had died at the Trade Center was included in this group of Americans who had basically been killed because they were Americans. That fact, that circumstance, gave her some solace and sort of eased the pain. And so her death was not without significance. It was part of a larger national tragedy. But as she said, she was an American hero. And also, I guess, she also believed that she would have been, you know, going to help as a physician. So Snea's death, the fact that her death was part of this larger national tragedy and this larger historical significance, even apart from her being as a physician going to help people, it gave them some comfort and some solace. And that was all taken away from them when they ruled, oh, she's not on the list. And then obviously they were very disappointed when the trial judge ruled, oh, you know, she died, but not at the Trade Center. And at that point, we took an appeal. We went to the appellate court.
What did you think when you got the decision?
I wasn't surprised, I guess. I thought it was ridiculous. It was just ridiculous. You know, as an attorney, you know, you win cases, you lose cases. And actually, the first boss I had, the only boss I had, he said 90% of the cases that you get as an attorney or trial attorney, lawyering doesn't make a difference. You could have Perry Mason. Well, I shouldn't say Perry Mason. you could have Johnny Cochran, Effie Bailey, or you could have the guy who got out of law school, you know, yesterday. 90% of the cases doesn't matter. The cases are based on the facts. The facts speak for themselves. The case decides itself. You know, and then there's a 5 to 10% of cases where lawyering does make a difference, where it could go either way.
And this was one of those cases, a complicated case, a legacy case.
We had one or two conferences with the court's clerk before we actually had the hearing. They were very, very doubtful of our case. I was just surprised. I thought, to me, as a not even being an attorney, just as a common, you know, as a person walking around with, as a sentient, if that's the right pronunciation, a sentient human being, what other conclusion could you reach?
I guess the big question which everybody had and that I would ask you is, obviously she stayed somewhere the night of the 10th, so it would have been either with somebody she knew or with a stranger. She
right.
stayed somewhere.
I mean, theoretically she could have walked the street all night. It's possible. It's one of those. Yeah, she could have been with a stranger, could have been somebody she knew, or she could have been walking up. I mean, I remember when I was in college once, I actually did that. I left the dorm at 8 at night. I didn't come back till like 5 in the morning. She could have been doing that, walking around. But more probably she would have been with somebody.
If she was with somebody she knew, though, why would they not come forward?
Well, obviously she wasn't with somebody she knew. Well, she wasn't with somebody that their family knew about. Okay. Yeah, they know that she was, you know, her last trace of her was a purchase she made at Century 21 because it was a credit card or whatever, store receipt. I think it was like 8 o'clock in the night, evening, something like that. That's the last actual trace. So they know she was at Century 21 sometime that evening of the 10th. Where she was in between there and the morning of the 11th, that you're right, that's not precisely known or determined. Just again, using logic, could she have been with somebody she knew? That's possible. But like you just said, well, if it was somebody she knew, why didn't that person come forward? Okay. Could she have been with somebody she didn't know? That's possible. Could she have been with nobody? Like I referred to my experience one night in college walking. That's possible. I don't know. You know, who knows?
It's interesting.
It's possible she may have been walking around the street.
With the heavy shopping bags, though?
I don't know.
She had a bunch of bags and a heavy shopping bag.
I forget the size or weight of the purchase. Okay, you're right. Maybe she wasn't walking the streets, but she probably, depending on the you're right.
So many questions, so many unanswered questions, so much we don't know. But that's okay, because sometimes the best clues are in the questions, in what people hide, what they lie about, in what we don't know. Next time on Missing on 9/11.
I just remember her confiding in me about not being happy in her current position, feeling pressured, whether there was pressure or not from her family, but feeling pressured to become a doctor, and then realizing she didn't really want to become one.
Homework this week. 1. Ellen Winner, the guardian ad litem, declined interview requests. Ellen, if you're listening, I'd still love to speak with you. 2. Do you have any new information on the LaFuente case? You can reach us by phone at 1-833-NEW-TIPS. That's 1-833-639-8477. Again, 1-833-639-8477. Or you can reach us via email at tips@iheartmedia.com. That's tips, T-I-P-S, @iheartmedia.com. Ben Bolin is our executive producer. Paul Deccan is our supervising producer. Chris Brown is our assistant producer. Seth Nicholas Johnson is our producer. Sam Teagarden is our research assistant. And I'm your host and executive producer, John Walczak. Cover art by Pam Peacock. La Fuente Judge voiced by Mike Smith of New Orleans. Special thanks to Tamika Campbell at iHeart and to Christoph Zappari in New Orleans. Also, thank you to Mark Bogatin and Aesop Rock. Original theme music by Aesop Rock. Check out Aesop's website at aesoprock.com. You can find me on Twitter at John Walczak, JonWalczak. If you like this show, check out our first season, Missing in Alaska, about the 1972 disappearance of two congressmen. Missing on 9/11 is a co-production of iHeartMedia and Greenfort Media.